Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Descanso, 89.1 FM, recording at our studio in East County. Today, my very special guest is Sarah Jacobs. She's a Democrat running in the 53rd Congressional District to fill the vacancy soon to be left by Congresswoman Susan Davis retiring. Sarah is one of 13 candidates in the race, and according to a recent Union Tribune poll, Sarah is currently the front runner. She says she's dedicated her career to building a better, safer world, fighting for the most vulnerable people, by making institutions and policies fairer and more equitable, and finding innovative solutions to complex problems. She's served in policy positions at the U.S. State Department during the Obama administration, at UNICEF, and the United Nations. She's a third-generation San Diegan who went to local public schools, and she holds a bachelor's degree in political science as well as a Master of International Affairs degree in international security policy and conflict resolution from Columbia University. She's the founder and chair of San Diego for Every Child, the Coalition to End Child Poverty. She's a scholar in residence at the Joan B. Kroc School of Peace Studies at USD. She says she believes in harnessing the power of technology to solve big problems, and she's been a fighter for children's causes. She's served as CEO and founder of Project Connect, a nonprofit helping close the opportunity gap for students around the world. She and her team actually helped map every school in the world with a goal of connecting them to the Internet, a project so successful that it's now a flagship part of UNICEF's work around the world. Sarah, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here with you.
Well, it's a pleasure. That's certainly an impressive resume.
Thank you.
Can you tell us what made you decide to run for Congress?
Well, as you may be able to imagine by the fact that just a couple weeks ago, I launched a countywide initiative on childhood poverty called San Diego for Every Child, I was not planning on running for Congress. But when Susan Davis announced her retirement after 20 years, I felt like it was really important that we had someone who had experience making and implementing public policy at the federal level, because we're losing 20 years of Susan Davis's seniority. And as you mentioned, I've worked in the Obama administration. I understand the different levers of power that the federal government has to get things done. And I felt like that was going to be really important to make sure our region was well represented.
Very good. I'd like to ask you, if you're elected, what are some of the committees that you would like to serve on? Would they be the same ones that Congresswoman Davis was on? House Armed Services Committee, Education was another, or do you have perhaps some different initiatives in mind?
I'd really like to sit on Foreign Affairs Committee or the Appropriations Subcommittee that does the Foreign Affairs Budget. And then I would like to serve on the Education and Labor Committee that Susan Davis was on. She mostly focused on higher education. I would really want to use that position to focus more on early childhood education.
So what are your key goals if elected?
You know, my team and I have knocked on thousands of doors. I'm talking to voters every single day, and some key themes come up with everyone I talk to. The first is gun violence. I talk to students who are terrified to go to school every single day, parents who are considering homeschooling their kids because they're worried. Another I hear a lot about, especially from young people, is climate change and the urgent threat that that poses to us. And then lastly, we know families here in San Diego are struggling with the high cost of living, and that includes housing, healthcare, childcare. You know, here in East County, we've got El Cajon that has almost half of their population who are living under 200% of the federal poverty line. Yeah. So there's a lot we need to do to address that.
Well, let's drill down and talk in detail about some of those big issues on the minds of so many Americans, starting with healthcare. Costs are skyrocketing, even for a lot of people with insurance. I told another congressional candidate in another race last week when I interviewed him 2 years ago on this, I was complaining my healthcare had gone up from $500 to $650 a month, and it just went up to $1,000 a month, $2,000 for my husband and myself. And obviously, this is beyond the means of middle-class families. When your healthcare is costing more a month than your mortgage, there's something wrong. So there's a lot of proposals out there. We're hearing all kinds of ideas from the presidential candidates, at least on the Democratic side of the aisle. What would your approach be to healthcare?
So I hear from families all the time about these high cost of premiums, the high copays and out of pockets, especially around prescription drugs. So many families who are struggling to afford the insulin that they need for their kid to survive. So I think healthcare is a human right, and we need to be doing everything we can to get to universal coverage. So I do support Medicare for All, and I would vote for any of the Medicare for All bills. I think there are about four in the House right now. But as you mentioned, it's not just about insurance. Insurance is very important, but we also need to bring costs down. So I think we need to crack down on bad actors in the pharmaceutical industry who are jacking up prices without doing any new innovation, like with insulin, like with an EpiPen. Mm-hmm. I personally believe that pharmaceutical companies should not be allowed to market directly to consumers. Right now, these companies are spending more money on marketing than on research and development.
Yeah, all those TV ads.
Exactly, exactly. And we know here in San Diego, biotech is a huge part of our economy. But when I'm talking to biotech folks here in San Diego, what they tell me is that the big pharmaceutical companies only come in after they've already absorbed all of the risk to figure out if something works or not. So what we need to do is actually increase federal government investment in basic science research, NIH grants, those kinds of innovations that we know are really important, and then figure out other ways to make sure we're still doing innovation while bringing costs down for the consumer.
Okay, thank you very much. On your website, you mentioned that unfairness is built into our economic system and noted that many families locally, as well as military veterans, are really struggling to make ends meet. What are some of your ideas for increasing opportunities for all in employment and jobs and so forth?
Well, first of all, I think it's really important that we fix the unfairness in our tax system. Right now, passive capital accumulation is favored in our tax code over hard work. So I think we need to increase the highest marginal tax bracket, but then also make sure that capital gains is the same as that highest rate so that we are not prioritizing people who are just investing when we are penalizing people who are working hard every day. We also need to close some loopholes in the tax code, and I think we need to expand the earned income tax credit and the refundability of it so that families are really getting what they need. And in terms of bringing jobs, I think we have a real opportunity here in San Diego. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to pass climate change legislation that includes a big investment in new green jobs. And I think San Diego is well placed to take advantage of those new investments that are going to be coming out, not only in green jobs, but we're very close to the ocean. And we know we're also going to need blue jobs, the blue economy, making sure that we're addressing issues with acidification of the ocean, using the ocean to farm food in a more sustainable way. And I think we have a real opportunity there for jobs here in San Diego.
You support the Green New Deal, I understand.
I do, yes.
Okay. Quick question on that. There's a lot of different ways to produce green energy, and we certainly need it to address climate change. That said, locally, we've seen some of the wind farms where there were some negative effects on the people who live very near them with the, you know, flashing lights and noise and so forth. Do you think that if a project is deemed necessary, but it causes harm, reduction in property values to residents, that either they just shouldn't be able to place them quite so close to homes, or if it's deemed necessary, like a freeway, that the people who have a property loss should be compensated or offered an opportunity to relocate?
So I do support a Green New Deal, and I think we need to get to an entirely clean energy economy by 2030, which will require huge investments in new ways of creating energy. Now, I do believe that if we need to do something that will impact property values, that we should compensate the people around there. And I also think that we need to be investing in the kinds of technologies that we know will be the least, will do that the least.
Like solar.
Mm-hmm. And actually, solar is our most renewable resource. We have more sun than anything else. And if we do it right, we can have it on every single roof, and we can have some big solar panels out very far in the desert. As long as we figure out some of the storage issues and we invest in our energy grid so that we can decentralize it and use this more efficiently, I think that most of that energy can come from solar.
Very good. Thanks for that. We are seeing women's rights and the rights of minorities under attack in Washington and in many states across the nation right now, with rollbacks and protections for things like access to birth control. victims of domestic violence, erosion of civil rights, voting rights, cuts in programs that help the disabled, and assaults on the LGBTQ community. I wonder if you could share your views on these equality issues.
So these issues are deeply personal to me. I'm a young woman, so for me and my friends, and for many women I know, what's considered women's healthcare is just our healthcare. This is a really important issue. So for that, I think we need to codify Roe v. Wade into law so that we're no longer relying on a court system that we know is increasingly hostile to our rights. And on issues of LGBTQ plus rights that you mentioned, I actually have my youngest sibling is a trans man, and my middle sibling is gender nonconforming. So these issues are deeply personal to me and my family, and actually some of the rhetoric coming out of the White House around these issues was part of what inspired me to run to begin with, because I think that we need to make sure that every kid in America has access to opportunity, who can fulfill their true selves, regardless of who they love or what their sexual orientation or gender identity is. And we need to pass the Equality Act into law. I'm grateful that the House has passed it. And like many good bills that have passed through the House, it's sitting in the graveyard that is Mitch McConnell's desk, even though we actually have the votes for it in the Senate. So we need to pass that. But we also need to make sure we're funding training for teachers so that they can spot bullying, and that we are addressing the epidemic of violence against trans people, and especially trans women of color, and that we're making sure that every kid knows that they belong here in the United States.
Okay. Susan Davis, as we mentioned, has long served on the House Armed Services Committee. What would your priorities be in Congress, Sarah, when it comes to balancing needs for defense spending in that defense budget, as well as caring for our military families and our veterans that have fought to protect us?
I talk to veterans and military families all the time. While we don't have any bases in the 53rd District, we do have many military family members and veterans living in the district. And Donald Trump just announced his new budget, and in it, he increased defense spending. And yet, here in San Diego County alone, 39,000 members of military families have to visit the food bank every single month. And I think that is unacceptable. I think we need to make sure we are taking care of the people who are fighting on our behalf, making sure that we're paying them, that we have housing available for them. But also one of the things I hear from military families the most is the need for quality education for their kids and access to affordable childcare. It's something that they're really struggling with. We know military spouses have a higher unemployment rate than the average population, in part because it is so hard to find childcare, and also in part because we need to make it easier for them to transition their credentials across state lines when they're moving for military purposes. I also think there are some easy fixes we can do. For instance, making sure that we're transferring people on the school year instead of the calendar year, so both kids and the spouses can finish out their education before they have to move, instead of now they move in the middle of a school year.
That makes a lot of sense. What will you do to try to make college more affordable and accessible, and also to reduce college debt that's just really burdening so many young people today?
So I'm a millennial. I'm of the generation that holds about $1.3 trillion worth of student debt, which means my friends are not buying homes, not starting businesses. We're not going into nonprofit or teaching or nursing jobs that don't have the kinds of salaries that we would need to pay back that student debt. Yeah. And that's not just bad for us. It's bad for the whole economy.
Right.
So first of all, we need to make college more affordable. I support tuition-free community college. And in talking to students, it's become very clear that tuition is not necessarily the biggest barrier. It's actually the cost of books, the cost of transportation, the cost of housing. So we need to expand what is eligible for Pell Grants to be used for so that you can use it for all of those other expenses.
Yeah, I was shocked with my kids when they went through UC to find out that now on-campus housing is more expensive than off-campus housing.
Absolutely.
How did that happen?
Exactly. Yeah. So we need to be addressing those other barriers besides tuition. My mom went to San Diego State in the 80s, and when she went there, it was $100 a semester. Mm-hmm. Now we know it's way more than that. So I think we need to increase affordability. I think everyone should have the opportunity to go to college debt-free. And then in terms of student loans, I think we need to vastly expand the public Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program. So if you're going into jobs like teaching or nursing, caregiving, or if you're starting a business, the things we know are really important for our economy and that not enough people are going into, that you would get your student loans forgiven.
Yeah. I could almost hear the fiscal conservatives out there in the district thinking to themselves, how are you going to pay for all this? It's just been announced, of course, that we have a huge deficit under President Trump. We actually have a much bigger deficit than we've ever had.
That's right.
Despite him calling himself a fiscal conservative. But how would you address the budget deficit issue? It's great to call for new programs, but how would you pay for them, or what would you cut to? Or do you have an idea for raising revenues to balance that out?
So part of why I'm running is because I believe we need a new generation of leaders who are at the table, who are really thinking about these challenges of the future. You know, it is going to be my generation and my kids who are paying off this deficit. So it's something that feels very personal to me and to other young people that I speak to. So I think there are a few things. First, we need to reverse some of the most harmful parts of the Republican tax bill, make sure that we are taxing capital gains, that we're closing corporate tax loopholes, that we're increasing the highest marginal tax rate. And then I think there are other revenue raisers we have, like a financial transaction tax, which I support. But I also think we need to be looking at what kinds of investments we're making. What are we spending money on? So if you look at affordable childcare, for instance, when the province of Quebec instituted universal affordable childcare, they actually raised more money from taxes from more people going into the workforce than spent on the program. So if we design these programs right, and if we're investing in the things we know we need to grow our economy, in many cases, they can be revenue neutral, or the growth of the economy will be so much that it will counter out itself.
Okay. President Trump's budget reportedly calls for cuts in Social Security, an entitlement program that we've all paid into, as well as safety net programs such as food stamps, Medicare, and some other things, programs for the disabled, as we've mentioned. Where do you stand on that? Will you protect those safety net programs and the entitlement programs such as Social Security?
Absolutely. I think President Trump's budget is the exact opposite of what we need to be doing. So first of all, in the defense spending, he increased defense spending and yet cut funding for State Department and USAID and our foreign aid budget, when if you ask any military general, they'll tell you the most important thing we need to be doing for our foreign policy is investing in the State Department and USAID and our diplomacy around the world. And then in terms of our programs here domestically, we should be ensuring that anyone who needs food stamps is able to get it, that anyone who needs assistance is able to get it. We know it's important for us here in San Diego. We have 50% of El Cajon who lives in families under 200% of the poverty line. So we need these services. And I think we need to make sure that our seniors are taken care of, especially by protecting Social Security and Medicare. These are programs that everyone paid into and that they were counting on when they retired. Personally, I think we should raise the cap on Social Security so that your any dollar of income you pay a payroll tax on, so that we can make sure it remains solvent and that everyone who is eligible for it receives it. And for women, actually, women are more likely to be in poverty in their senior years than men, partially because right now, if you take time out of the workforce to care for a child, a family member, it doesn't count towards your years for Social Security.
Yeah.
And I think we need to fix that, because that caregiving is a really important part of our economy and it should be valued as such.
Very good point. You have long been an advocate for children, Sarah. What more should Congress do to improve the lives of children in America, many of whom are living below the poverty level, including a lot of them right here in East County?
That's right. In San Diego County, we have about 40% of our kids who are living under the poverty line. That means countywide, it's about 200,000 kids, which means that they're not getting all of the basic building blocks they need that we know are really important. So from the federal government, there are a few things we need to do. One is increase the earned income tax credit and the refundability of the earned income tax credit so that low-income families are getting the full value of that credit. There's actually a proposal in the Senate right now that's bipartisan, introduced by Senator Michael Bennett and Senator Mitt Romney, that that fixes the child tax credit, because right now, while the full value of the credit is available for many middle class families, lower income families are only getting about $200. So it would fix that loophole so that lower income families are getting the full value of that tax credit, and also expand it so that you would actually get it monthly instead of just at the end of the year in a lump sum, which we know will be very helpful for families. There's also some really interesting proposals around things like what's called a baby bond, where every kid who is born gets a savings account, and then they get access to it when they turn 18, and they can use that to invest in buying a home, in their education, in starting a business, which will also help level some of the racial wealth inequality and the racial wealth gap. So there's a lot more we can be doing at the federal government level to make sure that we are creating a country where every kid has access to opportunity.
Thank you. What is your approach to immigration and border security? And can you also specifically address the separation of families that has gone on to such a huge degree under the Trump administration?
Absolutely. So first of all, I think we need to pass a Clean Dream Act. I think young people who are here in this country should have a pathway to citizenship. And actually, I was talking to a friend who's a dreamer who ended up moving to Canada because he couldn't handle the stress of not knowing whether or not he was going to maintain his status here.
Yeah, and a lot of these are kids that were brought here as babies or very young children.
Exactly.
They didn't have a say-so and, you know, in crossing the border.
Exactly. So we need to do that. Beyond that, I think we need a comprehensive approach to immigration reform, fixing the legal system that makes sure that we're prioritizing keeping families together, that we make sure our economy has the workers that we need without allowing them to abuse the visa system to pay people less. And I think there's a humane way to enforce the border, which absolutely does not include separating families, does not include putting kids in detention facilities, but does mean that we are focusing more on narco trafficking, on human trafficking, on what we really need our border to do. And frankly, I think we need to make sure that Customs and Border Patrol focuses more on the border than on interior enforcement. And I think they should be subject to DOJ civil rights oversight the way that police departments are.
Thank you for sharing that. What would you do at a federal level to try to ease the housing shortage in our region and also to address the homelessness crisis in San Diego County?
We have a huge homelessness and housing affordability crisis here in San Diego. And San Diego actually is the fourth largest homeless population in the country, and yet we're only 20th in terms of the funding that we get from the Department of Housing and Urban Development. I was actually in La Mesa for the Point in Time survey this year, which is when we all get up at 4 a.m. and go and count who is sleeping unsheltered at night. And thank you. And that's the number that determines what federal funding we get. And part of the reason why there's such a gap between our homeless population and the funding we get is because the federal definition of homelessness doesn't account for what we know homelessness looks like here in San Diego.
So things like people sleeping in cars
or
couch surfing.
Exactly. So we need to modernize that funding formula and make sure that San Diego is getting the funding that we need to address this crisis. I also think we need federal funding to focus on prevention. So making sure that we have federal funds available so that people have counsel in eviction court, and small grants that can be given out so that if it's just one small electricity bill that would be the difference between you staying in your home or not, that we have grants available for that, because it's so much cheaper to prevent homelessness than to address it once someone becomes homeless.
Yeah, the county has done some of that lately, and it's been successful in keeping people from becoming homeless, which becomes very expensive.
That's right. And then we know that we need to address our housing shortage. So first of all, I support a rental tax credit so that no family pays more than 30% of their income on rent. And I think we should make Section 8 vouchers a universal program. Right now, if you're eligible for Section 8, it will take about 8 to 10 years for you to actually get your voucher. I think it should be, if you're eligible, you receive it, much like other programs like Medicare that we have. And then we can use federal funding like a housing trust fund or a capital magnet fund to leverage public dollars to get more private investment to develop more housing that is affordable, that is for low-income families. And then the Republican tax bill mitigated the low-income tax credit, low-income housing tax credit. So we need to fix that so that it actually works the way it was intended to.
Let's talk about transportation, which has been a big issue in San Diego lately. Yes. There's a kind of a push-pull between those that want a lot more mass transit, which of course helps with reducing those greenhouse gases, getting cars off the road. But on the other hand, you've got areas out here where big housing projects were put in with the promise of, don't worry about the gridlock, we're going to fix it, we're going to add more lanes to these freeways. And the rug kind of got pulled out and the money got spent on transit things somewhere else instead. Are there ideas you have at the federal level for resolving some of the transportation problems that we have in our region? And can we do both? Can we have more transit and can we fix those freeways?
I think we have to do both. And I'm hopeful that we will finally pass an infrastructure package in Congress that is very overdue. The House Democrats have introduced a package that's $750 billion of investment, which I think is around the right number. And we need to make sure that that investment is going to fixing our roads and our crumbling, bridges and other infrastructure, but also goes to funding public transportation, which we know is incredibly important, especially here in San Diego. I also think as we're doing that infrastructure, we need to be looking at what we need to do for the 21st century. So expanding rural broadband, making sure that if we're digging for a road, we're also laying fiber optic cable, and then modernizing our energy grid, including by creating microgrids so that we can be more efficient in our renewable energy.
Yeah, speaking of technology, you have been a strong advocate of technology to be used for the public benefit. You come from the Irwin Jacobs family, the founder of Qualcomm.
That's right.
Can you give us some examples? I guess you could just give us one, but of what you might hope to achieve with regards to technology to help the public. And also, can you tell us where you stand on net neutrality?
So I support net neutrality, and I was horrified by the FCC's decision under President Trump to get rid of it and allow companies to decide how they wanted to throttle information. I've done a lot of work in countries around the world that do have that kind of rule, and it's not only that it's going to be more expensive, but I also think it's a human right that you should be able to access any information you want to access. And this is going to mean that private companies get to decide actually what you access or not. And I think that's wrong.
Yeah, scary.
Very scary. In terms of technology, I actually think that's one of the things that I bring to the table, that I don't know about you, but I watched those hearings with Mark Zuckerberg being asked questions by people who have clearly never used Facebook in their life. And it makes me a little concerned about who's making the rules. And so I think that there is a way to create rules of the road that mean that we are not stifling innovation, but we are ensuring that the future is going to be more equitable. So for instance, if you look at some of these algorithmic decision making, a lot of local police departments are starting to use algorithms to do predictive policing. Except we know that those systems are built on historical data, which we know is highly biased because our criminal justice system right now is highly biased. And if we don't have people in government who are making sure there are protections, then those systems are just going to exacerbate existing inequality instead of doing what they were designed to do, which is create a more neutral system that doesn't have that bias in it.
Yeah, tell us your ideas for reforms in criminal justice.
So we know that we have a criminal justice system that is highly unequal, that targets African American and Latinos at a much higher rate than white people. We saw here in San Diego just recently a report done that showed that African Americans were more likely to be arrested for resisting arrest, which I don't really quite understand that. But so I think we were able to pass at the federal level the First Step Act in a bipartisan way, which is exactly what it sounds like, the first step, but we need to go further. Now, 80% of people who are incarcerated at the state level, which means that at the federal level, what we can do is use block grants to incentivize states to change their behavior, including by using block grants to get states to modernize and reform their money bail system to get rid of private prisons. And at the federal level, we can focus on federal incarceration, make sure we're not using private prisons for that, do sentencing reforms building on what was in the First Step Act. And then I believe we need to decriminalize cannabis and make sure that we are pardoning anyone who is incarcerated because of a low-level cannabis-related offense that now would not be considered illegal.
Wildfires is always one of the biggest concerns in San Diego County. Any fire chief will tell you it's not a matter of if, but when the next large wildfire may hit our area. What more, if anything, can be done to improve our firefighting capabilities in our region? We've seen a lot of improvements, certainly since 2003, but there's, I think, room for improvement. What would you do?
That's right. Well, one of the things we need to do at the federal level is make sure that we have provisions in place to be able to respond as quickly as possible when something happens. Congressman Scott Peters actually has a bipartisan bill in the House right now with Representative Mark Meadows that would streamline that emergency response system so that it can be faster and we can provide support as quickly as possible. We also, as we do this infrastructure bill, as we build new housing, we need to make sure we're doing it with materials that are as fire resistant as possible, that are better also for energy reduction, energy usage reduction, etc. And then we need to make sure that we're working with the state and that the state has the funding they need to be able to provide these services to do fire management and, you know, frankly, water issues, which we know are a big problem here. Yes, a big problem here.
Despite the rain today. Yeah.
Well, exactly. And, you know, address climate change because it's only going to get worse if we don't address our warming climate.
Right. You hold a degree, Sarah, in international affairs, and you have worked in the State Department as well as the United Nations. What do you believe our nation's priorities should be in foreign policy? And along that line, can you, in addition to whatever else you may want to mention, can you comment specifically on your views on the Israeli-Palestinian situation, including the peace proposal put forward by Donald Trump, and the conflicts that we're embroiled in Iran, Iraq, and Syria, and I should add Afghanistan?
Absolutely. So I think that there's a way for the United States to play a leadership role in the world that makes the world more peaceful and Americans more safe without embroiling us in these forever wars that we have been stuck in basically my entire adult life. I don't know a day of my adult life where we haven't been at war, and that's true of everyone in my generation. So we need to be focusing on building up our diplomacy and our ability to do international development that have been gutted by the Trump administration. And we need to rebalance our foreign policy so it's being driven out of the State Department, not out of the Pentagon. And then we need to make sure that we're rebuilding our alliances, that we are investing in the international architecture that has been so helpful and so useful in maintaining peace, and also which we know is going to be increasingly important as many of the new challenges we're facing are transnational and will require international cooperation to be able to address. On the Israel-Palestinian conflict, I do not support the Trump administration's so-called peace plan in that I don't believe you can ever have a plan that will create peace that is entirely unilateral, which is what this plan was.
One-sided.
It didn't include any of the Palestinian leadership or any of the Arab neighboring states.
Right.
So, in my view, the only way that we will get an Israel that is safe and secure and a place for Palestinians to live in dignity and security is through a two-state solution. And I think the United States has an important role to play in helping us get there. And I believe that everything that we do needs to be moving us closer to that two-state solution because you know, unfortunately, just logistically, the window may be rapidly closing for that to be a reality. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be doing everything we can to get to a two-state solution.
And then on the conflicts in Iran, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, where our troops have been, you know, for such a long time, and where, of course, the danger of ISIS remains, what would you do there?
So first of all, I absolutely think that Donald Trump made the wrong decision in targeting Soleimani. I think we're already seeing the repercussions of that decision. Our allies are not supporting us. We're no longer able to do counter-ISIS operations, and Iran is increasing their nuclear enrichment without any of the checks that we had in the Iran nuclear deal.
And they've bombed our bases. We've got now 40 American servicemen with brain damage from that.
That's right, and we know that troops from San Diego have been stationed overseas as a direct result of that decision. So we need a foreign policy that is based on long-term how we can make the world more peaceful and keep Americans more safe. And I think on both those counts, that decision failed. Now, what can we do? So one of the things that we need to do is end the forever wars. While we do that, we have to do it responsibly. We have to understand how we're doing it so that we're not just creating a situation where we'll have to go right back because there is some conflict that requires our attention. But we do have examples where peace building interventions have been used around the world that we know what kinds of investments we could be making in the civilian side to really help ensure that as we're ending these forever wars, we're doing it in a responsible way.
Okay. I'm curious if you have any thoughts on South and Central America, where we're seeing a lot of the refugees that are coming to the U.S. fleeing violence in their homelands in those areas. Is there anything short of just either letting everybody in or sending everybody home and saying, you know, no, the doors are shut? Is there something in between that should be done to maybe try to stabilize some of those countries and reduce the violence down there so that people won't feel compelled to flee?
I believe that the United States has a duty to accept people who are fleeing for their life. I think it's important that we maintain the asylum system. And I've been horrified by some of the decisions by the Trump administration, like asking people to remain in Mexico while they're going through the asylum process, where they are in many ways susceptible to the same kinds of violence that they've been fleeing.
Which the United Nations has actually said is illegal, as is the separation of children from the families.
Exactly. And at the same time, it's entirely counterproductive that the Trump administration has pulled back aid from the Central American countries. So we had a program in El Salvador called a Partnership for Success model, where we created a plan together with the Salvadorian government that enabled us to work together to improve the economy, to improve safety, and it was very successful. We've also seen in places like Honduras how important it is to have the U.S. supporting the anti-corruption institutions, which Donald Trump has also pulled back U.S. support for, and which had been doing a pretty good job of addressing some of the corruption challenges that were happening there. So I think there's more we can do to both build up the economy and enable these countries to be able to address the violence there. That will be very important.
Speaking of corruption, many Americans today have voiced frustration over the power of special interests and big corporations bankrolling a lot of congressional campaigns, and then calling the shots in Washington. Can you disclose for us what the major sources of financing are for your campaign and if you're taking those corporate donations?
So I think we urgently need to pass campaign finance reform and overturn Citizens United. It's clear that our campaign finance system is not leading to the outcomes that we want, that special interests are calling the shots. So my campaign does not accept any corporate PAC money. I've signed the No Fossil Fuel Money Pledge, so we're not accepting any contributions from executives of fossil fuel companies. And I'm really proud of the grassroots donations that we have gotten. We've raised more contributions from grassroots donors than anyone else in this field. 60% of our contributions are $100 or less. Oh, I'm sorry. We have new numbers out. 75% of our contributions are $100 or less. And I'm very fortunate that I am able to ensure that I'm not asking people to invest in something that I wouldn't be willing to invest in myself. So I have put some of my own money into this race, which means that I'm more able to ensure that I'm not beholden to anyone except the constituents in my district.
Okay, that's very reassuring, I'm sure, to a lot of folks. What message, Sarah, would you like to give voters who may be upset about partisan gridlock we've seen in recent years in Washington? Currently, we have a Republican Senate that has stonewalled, I believe, every single bill passed by the Democratic-controlled House. They're not letting anything come up for a vote. The president has used executive orders to undo things like longstanding protections on clean air and water laws that Congress passed over the last 50 years in bipartisan fashion. And then we've seen, of course, the impeachment trial and the acquittal that have divided the nation. How can we get back to being a nation in which respect and working together across the aisle for the betterment of our country are the hallmarks of our leadership instead of the politics of divisiveness and hate?
I'm so glad you asked this question because this is one of the key themes of my campaign. I think we need to send a new generation of leaders to Congress who are able to respect each other, to listen to each other, and really to work across the aisle and actually get things done. And we've seen that the new members, the younger members, have in many cases been able to do this. So Congressman Colin Allred from Texas and Congresswoman Elise Stefanik from New York, both in their 30s, introduced bipartisan bicameral legislation to ensure that new parents have some funding that would be very helpful to them. I mentioned there was a proposal in the Senate by Senator Bennett and Senator Romney on the child tax credit. I can tell you when I'm talking to folks across the district that there are some things that we do all agree on. Everyone wants access to more affordable child care and understands the need for that. And so I do think that there are areas that we can really work together and start to get things done that will enable us to build up that trust to then work on some of the thornier issues.
Okay. Listeners, if you just tuned in, we are speaking with Sarah Jacobs, who is one of the candidates running in the 53rd Congressional District, looking to fill the seat being vacated by Congresswoman Susan Davis, who is retiring after more than 2 decades in Congress. Sarah, who are your major endorsements that you're most proud of, and where can people learn more about you and your candidacy?
I'm incredibly proud of the support we've gotten. I have incredible support in every single community in the district, and I'm also proud of some of the leading local and national organizations that have supported us. So here locally, La Mesa City Councilwoman Christina Licio, Lemon Grove City Councilwoman Jennifer Mendoza are some of my local endorsers. I've been endorsed by Congresswoman Katie Porter, Congressman Harley Ruda, Congressman Eric Swalwell, Congressman Andy Kim, and also a few others, and Lieutenant Governor Eleni Kunalakis. I've also been endorsed by Equality California, by the Longshore Workers Union, by the Postal Workers Union, and also by the MLK Democratic Club and the Eastlake Bonita Democratic Club.
Sarah, we are almost out of time today, but I'm going to let you have the final word today. What else would you like our listeners to know about you and your candidacy for the 53rd Congressional District seat?
Well, first, thank you again so much. You know, I'm incredibly proud of the campaign we're running. My team and I are knocking on doors and talking to voters every single day. We've knocked on thousands of doors. We pay our staff a living wage, and we have a paid internship program because I believe everyone should have access to getting experience working in politics if they want it. We have support from every single community in the district. And you can learn more and get involved at sarahjacobs4ca.com. That's Sarah Jacobs, no H, FORCA.com.
Very good. Thank you so much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Descanso 89.1 FM, the network for social justice.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been really great to be here with you.